This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Charedim. So first of all, when we talk about Charedim, what comes to your mind? If I said someone's coming into that room right now and they're Charedi, what assumptions now do you have about that person? Okay, they're dressed a certain way. If it's a man, then he's dressed in probably a black suit and a black hat. If it's a woman, she's dressed how?
Long sleeves,
a skirt, maybe stockings. If she's married, probably a wig or a head covering. Okay, what else would you assume?
No army.
Huh?
Devout learner,
someone who studies a lot of Torah.
No army.
No army service.
Maybe not so even basic secular education.
Lacking in basic secular education.
Living together with other Haredim.
Living in a Haredi neighborhood.
Thank
you. Lots of children. Mm-hmm. Okay. What about professional life?
None.
Doesn't work.
No, not for the husband. The wife probably.
Wife works. Husband doesn't work.
Yes.
Very interesting. And maybe he studies full time.
Some of them, such a percentage of them.
Yes, we'll talk about. In fact, they just said that the number of Haredi men in the workforce reached over 50%. The general figure is 83% for male society in Israel. So they're not at the average, but it's climbing. So we're going to talk about it. So I think where I'm interested in the Haredi sector, and I'm no expert in the Haredi sector, I want to say that up front, is because I share a lot with them in that I have a lot of the same books on my shelf that you'd find in the Haredi home. I also value Torah study. I also value going to synagogue. I share a lot of those same values and beliefs. At the same time, what is so strange are these big differences in certain core attitudes towards things that we're going to talk about, like Zionism and army service and secular education. So what I tried to do for you in the source sheet I gave you, and we'll go through it together, I did not try to give you sort of both sides of the story, like why they may not be Zionistic and what a religious Zionist say. My purpose is not to enter that debate. I tried to bring sources that reflect the Haredi perspective and Haredi point of view. Because my sense here is, especially if you're coming to something at Pardes, you're probably not looking to be convinced that the Haredim are not right. That's not your issue. Or it's okay to not be Haredi. I'm assuming that's not the question that people here have. But perhaps more a sense of, how do they see the world? How do they understand what Judaism is telling them? And how do they understand the role of being loyal to Halakha from their perspective? And so I tried to bring sort of a small taste of some of the key sources, both Talmudic and otherwise, that you'll find quoted in the Haredi world. But the first thing we have to begin to talk about is, who are the Haredim? When we say Haredim, it's often translated as ultra-Orthodox, right? Like there's certain beers, there's light beer, there's ultra-light beer. So I guess ultra means like super, really, intensively Orthodox. So, but we have to talk more specifically about who we mean by the Haredim. And I would say actually there are now, I would say, three sort of categories that we could be speaking about. I have very bad handwriting, but I'll use the board anyways. One group that falls in the category of Haredim, and again, these are generalizations, by the way. These are a way, they're ultra generalizations, meaning there are loads of exceptions to anything that I'm going to put up on this board. But when we speak generally, one group is the Hasidim, right? The different Hasidic courts, whether it's Ger or Slonim or Alexanderer and Vizhnitz and so on and so on and so on, the different Hasidic groups. The vast majority of them, Chabad, we might want to say is an interesting type of exception, or at least parts of Chabad, belong to what we call the Haredi world. Okay? Another group, I hope I spelled that right, are the Lithuanians. Okay? The Haredim that belong to Lita, to the great yeshivot of Lita, and they are not Hasidim, they are Mitnagdim. They descend from the opponents of Hasidut, and yet they also are part of the ultra-Orthodox world. There are some nuanced differences, right? The mode of dress. Hasidim, each group has its own basic mode of dress, but you'll see the men during the week wearing the long coats, and they'll often have the very long, curly peyote, and they might even have sort of those circular brimmed hats. This group will be wearing a regular black suit, white shirt, and standard black hat. Just as an example of different ways that you're looking at that. And now, in the last 20 or 30 years, there's another segment, and that's the Sephardic ultra-Orthodox, which we now have as well. They're new to the scene, but they exist as well, and they, interestingly enough, adopt some of the modes that you find particularly in this group, but they still maintain their Sephardic allegiance and connection. Now, these groups, even though we lump them all as Haredim, they don't always play so nicely together. I know you may have seen the story from about a year ago, I think, where a Hasidic school, I think in Beit Shemesh, was not allowing the Sephardic ultra-Orthodox kids to become part of the school. Marriage between these groups is quite unlikely. It can happen, but it doesn't happen that often. So although they share some of the basic characteristics of ultra-Orthodoxy, they are also, you know, the subdivisions do exist, right? And even among the Hasidic groups, there are certain social tensions and disagreements that happen among these groups as well. So even though we would call them all ultra-Orthodox, that doesn't imply that they all are the same. Okay? So before we get to the characteristics, I think, that sort of define the ultra-Orthodox world, I think we have to talk a little bit about where ultra-Orthodoxy sprang from, particularly in the context of Israel. So in the old Yishuv, and I'm talking about the Jews who were living in the land of Israel before the Zionist movement. So we're talking about from the middle of the 18th century through the early part of the 19th century. The old Yishuv is composed primarily of very observant Jews, some of whom came with their Hasidic rebbes. Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk is one, and there were others that came in the 18th century. And others were students of the Vilna Gaon, sort of the great leader of Lithuanian religious Jewry from the 18th century. And they came. And most of them came to live as the Lithuanians were called the Porshim, the people who left society behind and came to the Holy Land primarily to learn Torah. And both of those groups, they lived primarily, there was a community in Jerusalem, a community in Sfat, and a small community in Tveria. And then later on, a community in Hebron as well. Right, these are the holy cities of Israel, so you can imagine why the attraction. And many of them, not all, but many, lived off what was called the chalukah, or the chalukah, as the Ashkenazic Jews would pronounce it, which meant tzedakah donations. They were supported by the Jews of the diaspora to come and live in the Holy Land and learn Torah, and they had many kolels, and there were Talmidei Chachamim here, and that was sort of their lifestyle. Yes?
What about the people that were here already? Jews that were already here when these people come?
There weren't a lot. I mean, you know, the total number in Eretz Yisrael at that time was probably under 15,000. You're not talking about these large, impressive Jewish communities. But what's important to note is that those Jews that came did not come with a desire to build a Jewish state or political sovereignty. They were coming to the Holy Land, which always had religious meaning to Jews for centuries. They were coming to learn Torah and lead the utmost traditional Jewish life. And that community is actually enhanced in the 19th century, and this is kind of funny in a way, ironically funny, by Jews who are fleeing the Enlightenment that's happening in Europe. Because in Europe at the time, the 19th century, governments are granting Jews citizenship, but they're also making demands that Jews start to learn secular studies, that they start to speak the local language, and they start to acclimate themselves and modernize. Now, whereas some Jews were very excited by this idea, some traditionally minded Jews were very frightened by it, right? The most famous example is the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was rooting for the Tsar against Napoleon, because Napoleon was offering emancipation, and he thought that was very dangerous for the Jews. And the Jews were better off living the old way in the old country and not this newfangled type of citizenship that was being offered by France. Just as an example. Maybe he was right, depending on how you judge what you want. But the point I'm trying to make is simply that the Jews, the roots of the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel, were not rooted in Zionism or Jewish nationalism or any kind of political sovereignty. They were, in many cases, religious Jews looking to hold on to what they saw as a traditional way of life that was threatened by all the modernization that's happening in Europe. And of course, the numbers of this community really start to swell after the Shoah, because many survivors from Eastern Europe and from Central Europe, for that matter, make their way to Israel, and a certain percentage of them are Hasidic or Mitnagdim, and very much part of that world. The reason the history is important is because a lot of those same tensions over education and secularization and modernization that were happening in the 19th century carry over to what's going on here, with a very interesting twist, because now, right, the oppressor is not the goyim, it's not the non-Jewish government, but rather the oppressor is the Jews, secular Jews. But a lot of the tensions and the fears that characterize this dynamic are carried over and played out in the modern state of Israel, with the modern state of Israel standing in for the reformist Tsarist Russia, Germany, France, Hungary, and so on. But a lot of the same demands. So, the issues, any questions about what I said so far? Everyone's still awake? Okay, both of those are good. All right, so the areas that I sort of laid out that I think we're probably curious about in terms of sort of figuring out where the Haredim stand. Zionism, army, women and modesty, this last one sounds funny when I write it out. Working. Now, the last thing to let you know about how... Oh, I'm sorry. And secular studies. A lot of these are interconnected, right? As we'll see. Because part of what determines where you can work and how you work is the type of education you have.
And
issue of the army, and we can all tell Zionism is linked. So many of these things are linked, and we'll see if we can find a common thread. The other piece of history that I think is important to understand what was going on here is that before the founding of the state, this guy David Ben-Gurion, who had a lot of power here, he drafted something called the working agreement, is probably how you might train, or the status quo agreement with the ultra-Orthodox leadership at that time was Agudat Yisrael party. Because he was very worried when the UN was going to start interviewing all the different Jewish groups that were living here, he did not want a Jewish group to say, we think Zionism is terrible and you should not give the Jews a state. So because of that, he met with their leadership to say, okay, what are your demands so that you won't try to undermine this partition project? And what were some of their demands? Well, we know. One very famous demand was a deferment for yeshiva students, right? The argument being, after the Holocaust, that the yeshivot of Europe were decimated, and the ultra-Orthodox leadership was terrified about the future of what they called Torah Judaism. It's a funny term to use. I think most Jews would like to think they have Torah Judaism, but okay. In terms of the future of all that, and they wanted a deferment for full-time students. Now, the number of deferrals given out that first time was 400. Now they number in the tens of thousands, just so you understand what happened in that time. Another concession was kosher food in government institutions. That was a big one. And the other one that affects us still to this day is that the chief rabbinate would be in charge of marriage and divorce in the land of Israel. That there would not be secular marriage or secular divorce for the Jewish population in Israel. Yeah.
Isn't that also, though, a carryover from the Ottoman times when every religious group actually throughout the Turkish Empire handled their own?
It is. Remember, the Ottoman rule ended in 1918, and this is a good 30 years later, and there were no guarantees in this new state that was dominated by secular politicians that civil marriage would not have been an option. But the Haredim are basically saying, which we can understand from their perspective, if you have civil marriage and civil divorce, there are going to be illegitimate children, there are going to be all these problems. We can't tolerate the Jewish state being a vehicle for that. So status will be determined by the Rabbanut and not by anybody else. All of those pieces of this working agreement, although many of them were never fully ratified into law. For example, as far as I know, the army deferral policy is a policy decision from the Ministry of Defense. It is not technically a law. In principle, whoever is Minister of Defense could decide not to give out those deferrals. Okay, so that status quo agreement sort of dominated things here until a couple things have happened in the last 10 or 15 years that have changed the dynamic. One element is, and I think the biggest element, is simply the growth of the Haredi population as a percentage of the state of Israel. To give out 400 deferments for the army versus tens of thousands is fundamentally different. And the Haredi population today, I believe, is close to 10% of the population and growing because they have the highest birth rate in the Jewish sector. So they are no longer this small, right? Ben-Gurion presumably thought that Haredim and Orthodox Judaism was going to disappear in the new secular socialist Jewish state. And for a while, their numbers were very low. There was a person who I taught here with, Aryeh Sierkowski is his name, a wonderful, outstanding Talmid Chacham person. And he told me that out of his class of 35 boys, he grew up in Bnei Brak, 33 stopped being religious. But back then, there was a tremendous pressure. Because if you were religious, it was very unlikely you could join, right, the workers' union. And if you didn't join the workers' union, no job. So there was a tremendous social pressure that was happening that was really taking away a lot of numbers. And no one at that time dreamt that the Haredi population would grow in the way that it did. To their credit, the Haredi world succeeded, in Israel and abroad, by the way, to have a total revitalization after the founding of the state, and their numbers kept growing. Now, when their numbers kept growing, something else important also happened. Namely, the amount of government funds that were now going to be necessary to support Haredi institutions and pay all these stipends to these full-time students, and all the implicit welfare checks that are now going to have to be written for all these families that are going to sink under the poverty line because the fathers aren't working. Basically, and this is a very provocative word, but I'll use it anyways, the burden on Israeli society to maintain the ultra-Orthodox community reached a point where already by the 1980s, you have a politician like Tommy Lapid, who in the 90s is elected to Knesset, and the Shinui party gets like 15 seats because the Israeli middle class does not want to keep paying for this. And that's this whole idea of shivayon benetel, or this idea of equality of holding the burden. And basically, the Israeli middle class has said, enough is enough. And the Haredi world itself is under terrible financial stress. If you just take one example, and this happened already more than 10 years ago, there was a time when when the Likud came to power in 1977, the Haredi parties were always part of that coalition. And what the Haredi parties demanded from the Likud, from right-wing governments, hinged on financial issues. It was never foreign policy issues. It was financial issues. And the primary thing they always asked for was significant child subsidy allowances. To the point where a family with 10 children would receive about $2,000 from the Israeli government every month. That's a significant, that's a whole salary. And that significant subsidy would enable or helped enable the men to not have to work. When those subsidies were cut, and they were slashed dramatically starting about 10 years ago, the economic realities of supporting a society where the men are learning full-time and not working were going to chip away and erode that system. So that's what we're seeing today. We are seeing dramatic changes in Haredi society today, and we're going to talk about them. But first, let's go to the core about Haredi attitudes. So let's start with Zionism. What is so terrible? Why would we imagine that Jews who are passionate about the Am Yisrael and Torat Yisrael, what would be their problem with a Jewish state? The most common text that gets thrown around is a text from Tractate Ketubot about the three oaths. Are people familiar with that text? Okay. Now, the text of the three oaths says something like this. What were the three oaths? And one of them was that God made the Jewish people take an oath that Israel shall not go up to the land of Israel like a wall. The second, meaning, and so the question is, what does that mean, like a wall? Some people think it means en masse. Mass Aliyah. We promised God we were not going to go on Mass Aliyah until He told us it was time. Another oath is that God told the non-Jews of the world that they told the Jewish people they can't rebel against the nations of the world. And the third is that God told the nations of the world they can't be too harsh to the Jews.
I think the wall also is a metaphor of like overtaking a country.
So some view it that way also. Right, like a wall meaning as conquerors. Now, we're not going to get into, obviously secular Zionists could not care less of what some Agadita and Ketubot is saying about coming up to the land of Israel. But religious Zionists had their own answers to this question, ranging from, if it's pikuach nefesh, if they're killing us, we have no choice, the oaths don't matter, to the fact that the UN gave us a state, so we didn't conquer it, and so on and so on. But what's happening here in this text, I think, from the Haredi perspective, is this idea that Jewish political sovereignty is not something the Jews should be aspiring to. The idea that the Jewish people should try to create a secular modern state does not have inherent value, even if it's happening in the Holy Land. Now, there are sort of two pathways of this type of opposition. One of them reflects smaller, but it's more interesting, and that is the Neturei Karta Satmar Hasidic opposition. Take a look at this one. This guy lives in England, by the way, Rav Yerachmiel Dom. Zionism in and of itself represents a negation of faith in the holiness of the Torah and the holiness of Israel, in the coming of the Messiah and the resurrection of the dead, in reward and punishment and all things divine. Yikes. Zionism is a complete rejection of the basis of Judaism, he says. Zionism, the notion that we ought to have a state, freedom, and independence, does not ostensibly contradict any explicitly revealed precept, positive or negative. Right? Look in our text. You won't find, thou shalt not build a state. Yet it represents dreadful heresy. The heresy of Zionism, leaving aside the Zionists themselves, right? Even if they weren't secular, he's saying. Zionism at its root is heresy. Why? Amounts to a negation of all the principles of our faith. The idea that we ought to be a nation and have a state, a pollution that encompasses all other pollutions, a complete heresy that includes all other heresies. Or as the Satmar Rebbe put it, also a known opponent of Zionism, the very idea of the people of Israel achieving independence before the coming of the Messiah represents a heresy against the ways of the Lord, for it is He alone who enslaves and redeems. Namely, the Jewish desire to take responsibility for ourselves, to create a state, to build a sovereign state, is prohibited. In their minds, to be faithful to Judaism is to be faithful to political passivity, to wait in exile until God takes us out. Anything short of that, from their perspective, is rebellion against the kingdom of God. Yes?
If you live in Israel, can you say you're in exile?
I think that they do. And I'll just give an example. The Satmar Rebbe in 1967 wrote another book called On Redemption and Its Basically False Replacement. Don't be fooled, he said, by Israel's big victory in 67. It is a test. To this day, Satmar Hasidim will not go to the Kotel, or many of them won't, because that's part of the test. Yes?
But if they... thing like that, and but they live here, and they are getting money from the state. So isn't this a kind of
Nature, to their to be fair, the Nature Carta do not take money from the state. They live on donations. When the Satmar Rebbe was just here, he came around and he gave checks to all the schools in Yeshivot that don't accept a penny from the government. They won't deal in unkosher gelt, is the technical term. Unkosher money, money from the government. So the purists are pure. I think your bigger complaint could be towards all the people who take the money and still don't love the government. But those, the average Haredi position is not that of Satmar and Nature Carta, but rather it's more reflected in this statement from Rav Shach.
Even if they don't take money, they don't pay taxes as much.
Well, they kind of live off. Yeah, they kind of live off the grid. In America, they're like the separatists in Idaho, right? They don't file for taxes. They don't ask for permission. They try to live off the grid.
But they're using our services. They're using electricity, water. Medicine.
First of all, some of them actually have their own generators. Some of them do not sign up for Kupat Cholim. It's a very small percentage. Look, there were some years ago who wouldn't use Israeli currency.
What did they
use? Dollars. Try living like that. But it's a very small group. I think the Nature Carta is a total of, 300 households, 400 households. The majority are not taking that position. But the majority are still taking a position that views Zionism negatively, and I'm going to share with you why. We see a terrible and frightening sight, a collective revolt against the kingdom of heaven. There is a tremendous difference, Rav Shach said. Rav Shach was the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, and really the leader of the Lithuanian yeshiva world. From the 80s and 90s. There is a tremendous difference between an individual who sins and matters concerning himself and a mass community that is organized to live systematically a life of sin and iniquity. This is especially serious where there exists a Hebrew government in Eretz Yisrael. He's saying Hebrew with some disdain, by the way. We are talking about free Jews in our own state, the state of Israel, with our own president, with a government and an army, everything our own product. And who is it that prevents our holy Sabbath being observed here? It is a state of secular law, not a state of the halakha. So the critique there is not against the idea of a Jewish state. The critique there is a Jewish state. How do you define the word Jewish? For Rav Shach and for the ultra-Orthodox world, the only definition of Jewish that is acceptable means according to Torah and Halakha. Therefore, their problem is not the fact that the Jews have a state, it's the fact that we created a secular state. It's the fact that we create bus companies that run on Shabbat, that we create movie theaters that are open, and so on and so on. That we have beaches that are mixed, and all the other things that we are doing as a country. And for that, that is highly problematic for them. The difference between the two opinions, by the way, if the Jewish state decided to become a type of theocracy and we replaced our Knesset with the Muetzet Gedolei HaTorah, most Haredim would be okay with it. Satmar would still say no. If it's not built by the Messiah, we want no part. But the question that they are raising about the state, we can sort of at least understand or be sympathetic to. Because in their minds, a Jewish state that doesn't behave Jewishly is highly problematic. They can't support it. They can't get behind it. They can reach an accommodation with it. They can use government funds to advance the cause of Torah. But I think in many cases, it's they relate to the state of Israel not so differently than the way they used to relate to non-Jewish governments when they lived in the diaspora. You make an accommodation. You make the best deal that you can. But you don't see living under their rule as a reflection of some kind of ideal. And you're certainly not going to say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut.
So it's like living in Poland.
To a degree. Well, it's kind of yes and no. There's a very famous story, the Brisker Rav in the 1930s. Rav Chaim's son, who made it out here in the 30s before the Shoah began. And he founded a very famous yeshiva here. And there was a demonstration going on. And he saw one of his students scream at a policeman on horseback. Jewish policeman. And he went up to his student and said, "You're a Zionist." The student said, "What are you talking about?" Because for them, that's an insult to call somebody a Zionist in that world. And he said to him, "Would you scream like that at a policeman in Poland?" So he was onto it. And the Haredim today are also onto it. They know they're getting a better deal than they would have gotten in Poland. They know they're getting a better deal than they ever would have gotten in Russia and Germany or even today in the United States or anywhere else. They know this is the only country where they can say we don't want buses running through our neighborhood on Shabbat. They know this is the only country where they can say to the local bank manager, we want separate lines for men and women at the banks. They know this is the only country where they can prevent a movie theater from being opened up in their neighborhood. They know all that. At the same time, they still oppose a Jewish state, which for them is not the proper or acceptable definition of Jewish. Which leads us to our next issue, and that is army service. Why don't Haredi men go to the army? So I'll give you the text, and then I'll tell you what I think is the truth. The text is a very famous text from the Rambam about the tribe of Levi. And what the Rambam says is, why did the Levites not receive a portion of the inheritance of Eretz Yisrael and the spoils of war like their brethren? Because they were set aside to serve God and minister unto him and to instruct people at large in his just paths and righteous judgments. And he quotes the Pasuk from Dvarim. Therefore, they were set apart from the ways of the world. They do not wage war like the remainder of the Jewish people, nor do they receive an inheritance, nor do they require for themselves through their physical power. Instead, they are God's army. Okay? You get where this is going? That's the Rambam. And the Rambam, then, the next halakha, says the following. Not only the tribe of Levi, the Rambam says, but any one of the inhabitants of the world whose spirit generously motivates him, and he understands with his wisdom to set himself aside and stand before God to serve him and minister to him and to know God, proceeding justly as God made him, removing from his neck the yoke of the many reckonings which people seek, he is sanctified as the Holy of Holies. So there the Haredim argue, we're the modern-day tribe of Levi. We don't serve in the army because we devote ourselves to Torah. And it's a good thing we do, they would argue, because if we didn't devote ourselves to Torah, what would happen to Torah? We're not going to be able to learn all that Torah. They are the guardians of the tradition. And therefore, they don't have to assume the burden of army service because they are devoted to Torah. And to preserve that Torah, it's worth the price. That's what they will argue. It's worth it for the Jewish people that they should all be sitting and learning Torah. Then you'll hear other arguments that their Torah learning protects the country, that their Torah learning is a benefit to the entire nation of Israel. Now, remember, I'm also a religious person. I don't dismiss the value of Torah learning. I hear what they're saying, but of course we know there's a terrible problem, and that is when bad things happen like wars, and God forbid our children have to go to war. You know, I have a son who went to Gaza a year and a half ago. There are other people in this room who have grandchildren who are serving in the Israeli army. Suddenly, it's not about learning Torah versus going to college. It's about learning Torah versus putting yourself in danger. But they will argue this is worth it for the Jewish people, and this is what they want. Now, I would still argue that they also know that a lot of those army deferrals are being given to people who are not exactly sitting and learning 24/7. They know that too. However, I think, and again, I imagine many Haredim would argue with me, but I think the bigger issue for them is the acculturation that would happen if they went to the army. It's the fact that in the army, you are exposed to a lifestyle that is fundamentally different from the one that you grow up in your sealed-off neighborhood in Beitar or Bnei Brak or other Haredi neighborhoods. And I think there's a terrible fear of that type of influence that would happen if their young men went to the army. Now, to be fair, however, in 1948, many Haredim fought in the War of Independence. I'm told in the yeshiva of Hebron, about half the boys went off to fight. So some people claim that also what really turned the tide for Haredim against the army was the drafting of women. That when Tzahal decided to draft women, many Haredim said, well, then our boys can't be in that situation. So that's another factor in terms of what happened. Because in 48, they did fight. So something shifted there.
But women were fighting in 48 also, as a matter of fact.
I think...
defenders of tradition.
Correct.
They were just brigade of women.
Yes, that's true. And I think they saw that in 48 as either fight or die. But I think then that when they saw that there was going to be a policy now in the modern state of Israel to draft women, I think for them that was just like, what do you mean? We're going to send our 18, 19-year-old boys to go off to an army with a co-ed army? We don't send them to a co-ed high school, we're going to send them to a co-ed army. So now, right, one of the interesting shifts has been, well, no, Nachal Haredi's been before, it was almost 10 years already now, right? And their numbers keep going up. But that's connected to the fact that, remember, if you don't go to the army, you have to be in yeshiva to avoid serving in the army. You can't work. Which is why there's a certain cycle here that's very hard to break. Right? Assuming that Haredim don't want to be full-time yeshiva students until their mid-30s. But in order to get the army deferment, they have to stay in yeshiva. You see where that's going? So if you, in principle, will not go to the army, you are then trapped, is not a nice word, but you are trapped in the yeshiva. Because you can't work legally until you've, in this country, you can't work legally until you've fulfilled your army service. So that's why there was an attempt a number of years ago with the Tal law to allow Haredim at the age of 21 to take a year if they wanted to work or study in a vocational program and not need the yeshiva deferral, to encourage them to maybe think about moving out of that cycle. But the Supreme Court ruled that the Tal law was actually illegal, so it got struck down. And now the previous government tried to solve this problem punitively, right? It actually made it criminal to avoid the draft. And there were going to be all these limits on how many army deferrals, and now everything's back frozen again because the Haredim are back in the government, so none of this stuff is happening. That's where we are with the army.
Also, I think it's important to understand that the strength of the Haredim is in the intelligence sector of the army. But the intelligence wants a lot of the Haredim's capabilities of sitting and studying and handling these complex ideas in their heads. And I don't know, I don't think there is an intelligence.
No.
Oh, yes. My grandson was there.
I mean, there are some. Look, more and more Haredim now, I think the numbers keep on rising, are now doing or signing up for army service. And they've developed Haredi tracks, not just in infantry, which is Nachal Haredi, but they've also now, they're developing a track in the Air Force. There's a Haredi program for them to work primarily in computers and things like that. There are other tracks that they're developing. But it's not easy, because these Haredi tracks, there's certain agreements, right? They have to be in non-co-ed environments, and that's not always so easy to guarantee. They require a standard of kashrut that's higher than the regular army standard of kashrut. I had a student who did Nachal Haredi, and he was a lone soldier, and he was taken out of the field to go to this big party for lone soldiers that the army was throwing, and right before he got there, they showed him, said, you can't go. He's like, why not? Because there's going to be great food, there's going to be a lot of fun, because there are women there. You're not allowed to attend any co-ed events. You're a Nachal Charedi. So it's not so simple. But I think a lot of people feel that it's worth it, even though it's not at all clear whether the army is so excited about drafting all these Charedim because of the added complications in providing for them. Right? So it's complicated, but there is a growing trend of Haredi men to do the army, not, I don't think, because they're becoming passionate Zionists, although I think their identification with the state keeps growing. I think that that's very clear. They identify with the state much more now than they did 20, 30 years ago. But in addition to that, because they want to work. They don't want to be trapped. Because remember, if you don't do the army, then your exemption from the army only comes on your fourth or fifth child at the age of 29 or 31. That's a lot of years of being married and having children and not being able to work. And not being able to study in a vocational training program either. So going to the army is for a lot of them essential in order to take that next step. Yeah.
I think, though, it's important to mention that Nachal Charedi is not so widely accepted among the Charedi
for sure.
Community. And there was an incident, if you recall, in the news a number of months ago, of a young man who was in Nachal Charedi who went home, lived, his family lives in Mea Shearim, and he was beaten up.
Yeah. Well, Mea Shearim in particular is, that's Neturei Karta is located over there. It's the most extreme of Charedi society. What I understand is there are many young men, especially in the Haredi. Yeah.
Nachal Charedi is also made up mostly of.
Yeah, I know, it's not all Charedim. It all depends how you define Charedim and Chardalim. But in spite of all that, the numbers of Charedim that are going into the army keep growing. And from what I understand, in the Hasidic world, many young men who will ask the Rebbe privately, he'll give them permission to go to the army. In the Lithuanian yeshiva world, it's still really frowned upon. And by the way, it also affects things like shiduchim, right? If you go to the army, there are certain families that will not look at you for a prospective husband for their daughter, for the shidduch. Yes?
I think kids are simply ADHD and can't sit and study all day. And they're truant from yeshiva, and the army is a great way out for them. And there's increasing recognition in the community that that's the case.
Yeah, well, I think they've always known. They knew full well that a huge number, right? Let's be honest, the average person does not want to sit and study Gemara day and night for 20 years of their lives. They just don't. But in a community where that was your only option, I think a lot of people had to fake it. A lot of young men had to, but a lot of them were truant from yeshivot, and there's a whole subculture they call of these Haredi young men who are just out running around. Because they're in this trap. They can't serve in the army. They don't want to be sitting in yeshiva. They can't work legally. It creates a tremendous social pressure there also. Okay, let's talk about women for a few minutes. I'm quickly running out of time, I realize. Okay, so what's the deal with women? Why all these separate lines? Why this issue of separate seats on the bus? Right? We never heard of this in the Altaheim. In the old country, you never heard of rabbis saying, listen, when you're on the coach from Minsk to Pinsk, you got to make sure that they're separate seating.
Women are more provocative today.
That is what some people say. Absolutely. Provocative in terms of the way they dress.
In every way.
They go to classes and they voice their opinion. By the way, there are only three men in this whole room. Look at that. You're right. Okay, I need a screen, Deborah. I need some kind of mechitza. Well, I teach at Pardes, so that'd be a little unfair of me. So the Sifre, right, the rabbinic halachic midrash said about the Shema, right, what does it mean not to chase, explore after your heart? That's heresy. After your eyes, that's licentiousness. And after which you stray, that's idolatry. I just want you to notice, sexual promiscuity is up there with idolatry and heresy. So there is this traditional halachic norm that says sexual promiscuity is a real problem. It's a grievous sin. It has to be Avoid it. And the Talmud itself, we won't do the whole source inside, talks about how a woman's voice is erva. Erva is basically arayot, something prohibited to look at or see or experience, and the parts of her body. And as you mentioned, women today dress differently, and they're actually, I'm told, because I don't leave my home, but I'm told that they expose parts of their body that what men aren't supposed to look at. I've heard rumors that this is going on, and they're exposing thighs, and they're exposing their upper arms. And the Talmud even says, anyone who looks at the small finger of a woman is as if he's looked at her naked.
That's quite pathetic.
It's quite disturbing. Now, it could simply reflect, now, what they mean there by a small finger, presumably, the way it's understood is if it's exciting for them.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It took very little to excite a man.
I'm willing to say it still takes very little to excite a man. The question is, right, who does then the burden fall on, right? Even if we agree that men, I'm not speaking for you two, Tzadikim, I'm speaking for myself, that men are, you know, constantly thinking lustful thoughts every minute, that doesn't necessarily mean that the solution is to lock up women. The solution might be to lock up men. I'm just putting it out there. There's nothing here that suggests the way to handle it is to cover women, but we can at least acknowledge in most traditional cultures the way they tried to handle it was covering up the women. The Jews weren't the only ones, and we know from Muslim culture, almost every religious society I'm aware of, there are modesty rules for the women. Often not for the men, by the way, but for the women. Okay? So
the world is ruled by men. Exactly.
Yeah, and we've done such a great job. It's hard to imagine why we'd ever want to give that up. So what's interesting to know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and for the sake of brevity, we won't read the whole thing inside, but he was also brought some of these problems, right, where religious men in America are saying, hey, what about the subway? Anybody here ever ride the subway in New York?
Yes.
Ever ride a crowded subway in New York?
Yes.
Ever try to not touch another person on a crowded subway in New York?
Try.
You can try, and it's not possible, right? Sometimes it seems there's always more room because whenever the doors open, more people will get on. And somehow it's like the Beit HaMikdash Lahav deal that it expands somehow. Anyways, you know what it's like. And so some men were writing in saying, on my commute to work from the Lower East Side to whatever district, to the fashion district, I'm rubbing up against women. Or on the bus, there are not enough seats. What do I do? So Rav Moshe Feinstein said, and I quote, in source number two on this section, nevertheless, concerning other women, even if they are married and in nida, or non-Jews, everyone agrees that there is no prohibition to come into contact with them since it is not done in a sexual arousing manner. Therefore, there is no reason to be concerned about contact with women. Consequently, there is no need to refrain from traveling on subways and buses to go to work when they are very crowded, and it is not possible to avoid contact with women. He says very clearly, we got to live our lives. And therefore, you get on the subway, you get on the bus, and you lead a normal life. He's not advocating brushing up against women. I'm sure he'd be the first one to say, if the subway is got lots of space, you know those subway seats are really kind of small, you can't snuggle up next to some woman on the subway just because you want to. At the same time, he's also clearly saying that you can lead a normal life. In a crowded subway, you're going to be touching other people, and that's just part of what it means to live. He has another tshuva where he talks about a man is told by his doctor he has to walk on the beach for his health. And the man said, how can I walk on the beach? There are women there in bathing suits. Rav Moshe said, if you need to do this for your health, and it's not going to fill you with mad, lustful thoughts, walk on the beach like a normal person. So what shifted, I think, fundamentally, is that here in the modern state of Israel, Haredim had the political and civil clout to change the norms. Right? They had the capacity to say, well, we want to cut, we are a huge percentage of this bus lines business. We want to have separate buses. Right? Or we don't want the pizza shops to have sit-down tables anymore because we don't want men and women fraternizing at the pizza store. We don't want the bank to have co-ed lines. The reason all that happened, I think, fundamentally, is because as Haredim in the 70s and 80s started to feel their political power, they had an aspiration to put into practice rules that were part of like these theoretical Musser books that would tell you you have to avoid looking at women. Do you understand? In other words, you could buy like the Orchot Tzaddikim or these other books and you learn yeshiva. It's usher to look at a woman. Okay. That's, I understand an 18-year-old yeshiva boy is reading that in his yeshiva. The difference is the 30-year-old Haredi man can now make that public policy. Right? He now has a situation here in Israel where he can now make that a reality, as opposed to Rav Moshe writing in the 60s saying, listen, this is New York, this is a subway. What do you think would have happened if ultra-Orthodox Jews had asked the New York City subway system for separate male-only cars? They would have been laughed out of town. But here in the Jewish state of Israel, when you make up 10% of the population, you can ask for those kind of things. And they do. And they continue to.
It's about power.
It's about power. It's also about a power that they see to use to sort of shape a religious ideal that, in my opinion, was never meant for everyday living. It was meant to teach a value. Like, I'm okay with the idea that they're saying, boys, you shouldn't be ogling women. That's actually a pretty healthy thing to teach lots of young men, I think, who stare at women. Because I think a lot of women don't like being stared at, quite frankly, or approached, and so on. I don't think that's a terrible thing to tell men. Don't stare at women. Don't brush up against women. I think that's a very healthy thing to teach men in certain contexts. But when you transform that into women have to sit in the back of the bus, women have to stand over here, women have to dress a certain way if they're going to come into this store, you've like turned the whole thing on its head, right? You turned a religious practice geared towards the individual man, and you've now turned that into a set of rules for the women. That is something that can only happen in contemporary Israel. Maybe there are places in Well, you're from Toronto, right? Are there places in New York or New Jersey, like in Lakewood, does a local grocery store have a dress code? I can't believe it. New Square might. But like, there are stores in Beit Shemesh where if you're not wearing a skirt, you can't go in. Absolutely. Or if you're not wearing sleeves, I mean that because they can. But that is relatively new. Okay, let's keep going. What about working? What is so terrible about working? So we're not going to look at this one inside because we're really running out of time. But I just want to make a note. The original problem, halakhically, was that you weren't allowed to earn a living from Torah study. How do you like that one? The famous line in Pirkei Avot, the Torah can't be a shovel to dig with. The original halakhic problem was, how can you pay rabbis? Sounds funny now. And as a rabbi who gets paid to teach, it's not so funny. But
the Reform movement still does that. They pay rabbis for what they do if they weren't rabbis.
Well, and that's one of the heterim, right? That they're paid for their... Oh, thank you, Deborah. That was very kind. And so if you look, Rav Yosef Karo, the Rambam was very opposed to it. Take a look at the Rambam's language. I'm in source number one. I had wanted not to speak about this commandment because it is clear. It is known that my words will not be pleasing to most of the sages of the Torah, perhaps all of them. But I speak without concern, without favoritism to anyone. He was about 20 years old when he wrote that, by the way. Know that it has already been said, do not make the Torah a spade to dig with. Meaning, don't use it as a mechanism for making a living. The Rambam was very clear, you're not supposed to do it. And he says, Hillel the elder was a woodchopper. Rabbis of old made their living, the Rambam was a doctor. For a while he was supported by his brother, but he never took a penny of tzedakah money as a rabbi. So Rav Yosef Karo, coming later on, says it's an emergency decree because if the students and teachers of Torah did not have a livelihood, Torah would be forgotten. So it's just interesting, this idea of working, which I think initially was a positive value, it became inverted in the contemporary Haredi world. And by the way, this is a new phenomenon. You did not have, in Europe of old, all these kolels and married men who were studying Torah and not working. It was extremely rare. Boys went off to yeshiva only if they were very talented. At the age of about 12 or 13, and by the age of 18 or 19, would either leave and go to make a living, Or if they were really talented and they chose the rabbinate, they would then get smicha and by the age of 21, 22, start serving as local community rabbis. You did not have, except for a very rare few, who were lucky enough to be supported by a wealthy father-in-law, the type full-time students. There are more full-time students today in the Jewish world than have ever been before, by far. So what happened? It's part of the same phenomenon. I think working, by the way, and I realize I just interrupted myself, the idea that the husband should learn while the wife works is also a cultural transformation in the Haredi world. What does it say in the ketubah? What's the husband's job?
To support
the wife. The Chazon Ish in the 1940s and 1950s is the one who said it is preferable for women to go out of the house to work to enable their husbands to study Torah. And the Hasidic world took that on also. Why? So in my opinion, and it's just an opinion, it has a lot to do again with the integration and fear of the outside world. Men learning Torah full time was a way of ensuring traditional lifestyle. I think there was an assumption that women, especially married women, were far a safer bet to go out into the world and work than were a 22-year-old man. Yeah.
But it was also the model for much of society in America that the wife worked to put her husband through college in secular society in the 1950s, because there was this huge need to withdraw women from the workplaces they had been in throughout Second World War.
Look, I think, I don't know how widespread. I think my sense is that if men went to graduate school, there was like, you have these stories of the doctors who their wives work to put them through graduate school. And
I knew a lot of women who dropped out of school, you know, a year or two in college to support husbands.
Okay, let's take a look. It's already almost 9 o'clock. Let's take a look at secular studies for a minute, only because I think it's interesting. We're going to skip over the Talmudic passages because the final key to this puzzle, of course, is the Haredi educational system. The Haredi educational system today is called Chinuch Atzma'i. They are not part of the government educational system. They are a separate educational system that still gets funding from the government. Go figure that one out. And it is an educational system that is noted primarily for its lack of secular studies, particularly for boys. And there's also this whole conflict over what's called Nosei Liba, the heart of the curriculum, which would include things like civics, English, math, some basic science. The standard boys' curriculum ends all secular studies at the end of sixth grade. Which means Haredi young men have nowhere near the tools they would need to take the matriculation exams to get a university education in this country. And that is a piece of how the system is designed. They also lack computer skills, English language, and math skills that would enable them to be hireable. Right? So now you're thinking it's an educational system that is geared towards producing full-time yeshiva students and to make going out to work much harder. Because unless you're going to work in some kind of small business, right? You're in a sfarim store, you'll sell as a scribe, as a grocer, you know, unless you're all the professions are closed to you by definition. So think about the implications of that. Why is it done that way? Again, I think it's a bulwark against really assimilating into the outside world. Now, a guy I heard on the radio was interviewed, and the radio announcer said, "Tell me something. Why don't you give your boys at least the basics so those who don't want to end up in yeshiva their whole lives can still support themselves?" The answer was fascinating. He said, "We want to produce more Rav Elyashivs," who was the great Talmid Chacham at the time in his community, Alav HaShalom. And the guy said, and even though we know only one out of thousands will be a Rav Elyashiv, it's worth it. So it's a striking answer.
That's one answer. There's another answer which says they can take a year after
They can make it all up.
They can do a complete 5-week map with 1 year of study. It's just phenomenal what they're capable of.
Some.
The big problem, many of them, the big problem is English. And they're beginning to deal with that because you can't do English in a year.
Correct.
Talmud's mind is not
Even the math, I have to tell you, as a Talmud teacher, right, there's, I think, it's somewhat of a mythology to think that because Haredi boys study Talmud at a young age, that they all become these academic wizards. I think some might, but many of them are going to have fallen behind and are going to stay behind. Because we know that even those that try to enter the workforce, the Haredi community is, next to the Israeli Arab community, the most impoverished community in all of Israel, both because of the high birth rate and the fact that so many of these husbands don't work.
One's by choice and one's not by choice.
It's a very, and the point there is, imagine if you're a 17-year-old Haredi male, you've already been put in that position, right? In other words, it's not like you are now saying, I am choosing this. You haven't been given a textbook since you were 12 years old. And you've been told, in fact, that the ideal is to constantly learn Torah and as much Torah as you can. That's a lot of social pressure to then, for that young man to then choose something different. Because every time you go to shul, every time you sit in class, your teachers, your leaders are always telling you, Torah studies the ideal, that's what you should be doing. It's a tough road. Now, if you take a look at some of the guidelines, one of the very well-known rabbi, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who is an amazing man. He was in America when World War II broke out, and he actually came back to Poland to die with his students. So he's a remarkable man, a Rosh Yeshiva, and he was a very big opponent of secular studies and modernization. Here's what he said. Wasn't a big fan of Zionism either, by the way. It is first glance difficult to understand, given that there are many different areas of valuable knowledge, why we'd say that any matter that is not Torah should be categorized as a waste of time, right? It seems like there's a lot of good stuff to know out in the world. Why can't we take time off from Torah study to learn it? When we examine, however, current external wisdom, we discover that the wisdom of Aristotle and the like has been disproven. We have signs and demonstrable proofs. We can no longer rely on it. This is true of many areas of science, where the knowledge of today cancels out completely what was said before. This is not true of our holy Torah, where it and true wisdom are one, for God's wisdom does not change. You like that argument? Why study Newton? Einstein's just going to come along and show where Newton was wrong. You might as well spend your time studying the one thing that will always be true, Torah. I like that argument. It's kind of funny. He also then was asked, okay, Rav Elchanan, lay out for us, when is it okay to study secular subjects? I want you to notice the rules here. Number one, if studying the subject will bring one to read heretical books, it's completely prohibited. Okay? So, if you're going to go to a school that has some kind of fixed curriculum and you have to read the Bible with some Bible critic, you can't go. If you're going to go and they're going to teach you evolution and biology class, you can't go. You see where that's headed. Number two, if it does not require one to read heretical books, but one would need to study in a gymnasium is probably how it should be pronounced, or university among Gentiles, and one can see that it would cause one's son or daughter to fraternize with Gentiles and learn from their ways, it's also forbidden. Meaning, because who are the Gentiles today? Secular Jews. So therefore, if you have to study these subjects, and it puts you in an environment where you then are socially interacting with people who are not strictly observant, also prohibited. Number three, if such study would not lead to either of the previous two conditions and one needed to do so in order to support oneself, it is permitted. Aha. So, secular studies that is not heretical, is done in a completely kosher environment, would be allowed as long as it was necessary for parnasa. Number four, if one does not need to study these subjects in order to support oneself, but is doing so for personal pleasure, it is forbidden. This guideline is basically what we see happening, where there are more and more Haredi vocational colleges, both for men and women, but they are separate, where they learn a profession, computer science, accounting, physical therapy, nursing, There are many of these colleges that are popping up, and these colleges are built to fill in some of the gaps that they did not get in high school. They don't require a matriculation exam to enter, and they are seen as a great hope in trying to integrate more and more Haredim into the workforce. Because remember, to join the workforce more and more means an education. There's a limited number of sort of jobs that could support a family that don't require basic computer skills, math skills, English language, and so on and so on. So, what do all these things in my mind have in common? I'm going to sum up. I'm sorry I went over time. I apologize. Again, it goes back to the Enlightenment. What is the experience of the Orthodox community? The experience of the Orthodox community 100 years ago is when you open up the gates, the kids leave. When people are given a choice between leading a traditional lifestyle or a non-traditional lifestyle, they choose the non-traditional lifestyle. And I would argue the fear of the younger generation leaving the fold is what has animated and driven a lot of these decisions. This sense that the non-Orthodox secular society is a threat to the values and lifestyle that animate this community, I think drives a lot of the decisions that are going on. That, I think, and that's an historical reality for them. Right? Their historical reality is when the Enlightenment came and emancipation came, the image of all those Jews who started to work on Shabbat and go off to university and stop leading a religious lifestyle animates a lot of that fear. I think that's one piece of this puzzle, okay, that I think accounts for a lot of the reactions that we're seeing and a lot of decisions that were made. I also think, though, there is a counter pressure now where the economic realities and the free flow of information, where today, because of the internet, because of advances in communication, people know stuff, people are aware. You can't really build effective walls to the same degree anymore. And there are many, an increasing number of Haredim that want a lot of the positive benefits of a modern, more financially stable lifestyle. And I think that's both of those things are playing a role in what I think is a slow but steady transformation of the Haredi community, where it will morph into something that is more open, more culturally integrated, and more part of the State of Israel than it was 20 years ago and than it is now. I think that's the trend where things are heading, but it's going to be a bumpy ride. And there is a lot of resentment in Israeli society because of the fact that you're dealing with an impoverished community that chooses to be impoverished in many ways, and that creates a tax burden and a social burden and the army burden that a lot of people are pushing. But the real debate now is how do you want to facilitate the change? Some people are arguing that the way to facilitate the change is to legislate it and try to force it. And others are saying it's going to happen on its own. Try to find Haredi partners to facilitate this process. And I see both sides, if you want to know the truth. Because I see one side might be saying, it's going to happen, be patient. I see another side saying, we're angry, we're frustrated. We don't think it's fair. So, either way, they are a very interesting slice of Israeli society. And again, don't prejudge just by how people are dressed. Don't assume you know what people's political views are or how they live just because how they look. And I was speaking in very big generalizations, but obviously in every community there is a lot of nuance, and keep that in mind. Laila Tov.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.